We have a question here. And is there another question already? Does somebody have a microphone over here? Raise your hand so somebody can get to you. And yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Erica, and I live in Chicago. I work in a high school. And so I'm always curious in talking to students about avenues towards change. And specifically for you, DeRay, I know you started grassroots, and now you're running for mayor. And so I was curious if you could talk a little bit about what change looks like when we're talking about making large systemic change and knowing that the mayor does have a role with policing, as I've seen very evident in Chicago. And just curious about what do you think in terms of success and being successful top-down versus grassroots, even though I'm sure it's a combination of both.
Yeah, so I ran for mayor. I didn't win. The election was April 28th, 26th, but it was a good run. In terms of what, so I agree with much of what Sherilyn said around, like, this has to be a fight at every level, right? That it has to be at the courts, it has to be at City Hall, it has to be at the school board. We have to fight at every space. I'm a believer today, though, most in the small changes that can change culture, that can change structures that will make big changes in culture. So again, I talk about the police union contracts and use of force policies because they are seemingly really small, but you think about places like Baltimore where it is still okay to hog tie and chokehold people. So if an officer does it today, it is not against the rules, right? We can be really upset about it as the public, but it's not wrong today, right? And going to what Sherilyn said is that we've allowed that to happen, and the question becomes how do we get the mayor to do an easy policy change, right? Nobody has to vote, like the city council doesn't vote on the use of force policy in Baltimore City Police Department. Or you think about places like Detroit that somebody spoke about earlier. Detroit has this 48-hour rule in their contract. So an officer cannot just be interrogated on the spot. They have to get 48 hours notice that an interrogation is going to happen, right? Which is a protection that any lawyer can tell you their client does not get today. So we believe that if you change those structures, these seemingly small things, if you change a set of them, that it actually changes the culture. The culture becomes more accountable. NFL swoop that we've seen happen in different ways with medicine. We've seen it happen in the teaching profession, that you change the structure in demonstrable ways that the culture changes. So I believe that that will have a real impact. I think that there are lawyers who are fighting in the courts, and I think that that has to be a part of the struggle. I'm not a lawyer. But when I think about what activists can do that's like really meaningful, it is things like the contract. It's like the use of force policy. It's like the civilian oversight board. You know, when I think about it, we did this big study on police union contracts, and I talk about them a lot, but there are clauses across the country that says the police chief is the final arbiter of discipline decisions, which most people are like, that makes a lot of sense because it's the police chief. That is the clause that people use to disempower the civilian review board, right? Because only the chief can make the decision, so the review board can only make recommendations, right? And we are trying to lift up those things. When I think about what protest is at its heart, protest is this idea of telling the truth in public. And that's what we have been trying to do for the past 20 months, and we believe that there's real power in that.
So, Roberto, you know, I'm in New York. I was watching the stop and frisk protests from the very beginning, when they were a very small group of very radical community-based activists who were raising this question,
a decade ago,
mm-hmm. Right? So if you were the chief then, and you had this group that was just like hammering it over and over again, would you have been happy to have them around as a police chief? Would you have been saying, you know what? I'm so glad that our American democracy allows for this group of activists who are really causing me a problem because they're drawing attention to this thing, which I believe is working.
Well,
would you have been
I said earlier at a panel that we took part in just before this, I think heat is often a good thing because it causes change. And would I have been happy? No, I'm not going to lie to you and say I would be happy about that. But I did face a very similar issue with immigration in Arizona. And that we had a law that was passed that required certain things of local police officers and got us involved in immigration enforcement, which is the last thing that local police should be involved in. We should be there to protect the safety of everyone involved in our community. And how do we protect the safety of a whole class of people who now will not talk to us because they're scared that if they talk to us, we're going to turn them over to Border Patrol? I vocally opposed this law. I said that's not what we should be doing. But the law passed. It went up to be heard before the Supreme Court, and one element of it was not overturned, which was the most onerous element, which talked about we had to check people's background when we arrested them or when we had a suspicion. We were obligated by law now to do that. So there were a lot of people upset in a southwestern town like Tucson. I'm sure you can understand that. and I was constantly meeting with different groups. And through those meetings, there was a lot of dialogue that occurred that brought forward issues that I would not have thought of myself just looking at it from my perspective, which comes from a law enforcement perspective, and not necessarily from the people who live in the community who have to have a voice in how we develop our policies, our training, and our discipline methods. And by listening to those voices, sometimes I wasn't happy, but we came out with a response that, for the most part, was, in my mind, very fair. There's always going to be critics. There still are, I'm sure. But at least I felt we were doing the enforcement of the law in a professional manner, and I could defend that. And so, no, I would not be happy, but I understand the necessity of that type of conversation and that type of, oftentimes, conflict in coming up at a suitable solution, because really, any decision we have going forward should probably be a little bit uncomfortable for both sides of the equation, because you can't always win, and you have to really try and make sure you're looking at the other viewpoint.
Right, I'm going to take your question in the audience. Where are you? There you are. Just also for a second, the thought that, and maybe you can jump in on this later, Sherilyn, that you have an entire sector of the population that is actually actively not wanting to engage with the police in any level, and in particular when they've been victimized, whether they've been sexually assaulted or there's been a domestic violence or they've been robbed, and that they will not pick up the phone and call the police. It would be the last thing that they call the police. And what does that say about us as a country, right, where you have a whole sector of the population that is actively disengaging, and also because they believe that, which is true, that they don't have any access to due process once they're turned into the immigration side of the legal system. It's something that we have to sit with because it's part of who we are, and oftentimes that part of the conversation doesn't come to the top. We'll come back to that, but your question, please.
Yeah.
And if you could stand up, just identify yourself.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Zach Cheney Rice. I'm a reporter with Mike out of New York City. I have a question for all three of you about policing technology. Specifically, because we're on a panel about rebuilding trust, repairing something that is broken, maybe was never actually functioning the way it was supposed to be, but at the same time, police are finding new innovative ways to police through technology, and a lot of these technologies, whether through criminalizing specific areas or trying to predict who's most likely to predict to commit a crime in the future, are in a lot of ways reinscribing racial bias into policing via new technology. So what are all three of you doing to kind of stay on the vanguard of that and make sure that, you know, while we're fighting problems that have been in existence for a long time, what are we doing to, like, kill these problems that are coming up?
Using technology. Again, if you have a question, raise your hand so the microphone can get to you. Who wants to jump in?
So I'm so glad you asked that question. This is really the, you know, brave new world and quite alarming. So face recognition technology, you know, scanning a photograph of the crowd that was standing around a crime and then putting those that face recognition into police databases and coming up with, you know, who was there. Monitoring social media is a big one that's, you know, was used up in New York to do some sweeps in public housing. And then, of course, the predictive algorithms about who is likely to commit a crime. These are really scary ventures that we're actually just trying to get a hold of. We're understanding, first of all, some of the technology. Understanding algorithms is like a, you know, they're not supposed to be understood, right? And really dealing with the built-in narrative of neutrality that surrounds them, and this concern about embedding implicit bias and, in some instances, explicit bias into these technological forms of surveillance are a big deal. And so we have a little kind of unit that is actually beginning to explore this right now. First of all, trying to understand the various ways the technology is being used. You know, we don't panic about it. You know, if you drive through Baltimore, there's blue light cameras, you know, in certain neighborhoods just posted up, surveilling the neighborhood at all times. So there have been, you know, surveillance and privacy issues in minority communities for a very long time. But this presents really unique challenges. And for us, it presents particularly unique challenges of thinking about how we would litigate in the context of evidence presented from that technology. And that's just something we are in the process of learning and want to learn more about how we're going to engage it as a matter of litigation.
Dre, are you concerned about, you know, the technology and then the creation of lists? You know, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the watch list and making sure that, you know, well, people who are on the watch list can't, you know, shouldn't be able to buy guns. Who's on the watch list? Who are making up those lists? Shall we remember some of the lists that have existed in our country? The black list, the Japanese-American list, the Mexican list, the gay list. These are lists, right? And now we have... I'm sorry,
the red list.
The red list. You know, how do we now couple that with the fact that we've got this technology, which everybody seems to think is like the best thing that ever happened to us?
Yeah, so I'll talk about two specifically. One is Stingray. So in Baltimore, they have the Stingray, which can access your cellular devices, and we think that is really problematic. There have been cities across the country in protests where all of a sudden the cell signals have been jammed and you are struggling, right? And we don't think that is good. Like Sherilyn said, though, it is the technology is so new that we're trying to understand it in a better way. Body cameras is one that people talk about often, and we have publicly said we support body cameras to a certain extent. The hard part about body cameras is if you believe in community policing, which for most people is this idea that the police should like be in communities, which we would say, and when we met with Obama, when we met with Valerie and Loretta, we said to them, we think community policing is really like a race-based way of thinking about the police. That if you think about the Upper West Side, nobody's saying community, nobody's saying the police should just be there high-fiving Timmy when he gets off the bus. But people are saying that, like, in black communities, the police should be everywhere. They should be playing basketball. They should be, like, at the way, like, they should just be ever-present. And if you believe that and you give every officer a video, a body camera, then you have now created, like, a whole different type of surveillance in neighborhoods. And we think that that is actually really dangerous. What is also real is that the legislation around body cameras was faster than the movement was. So all of a sudden, these cities started passing this legislation, and we just didn't have our, you know, we were still in the streets getting tear gassed by police departments. So you think about places like D.C., where in D.C., the officers can look at the footage before they write the police report. We think that that, like, defeats the purpose, right? So we are trying to undo some of the damage that's been done with them, some of those laws, and we also are working with partners around the storage piece. Mm-hmm. So we would love it if the storage was automatically deleted, if it was housed in a place that wasn't managed by the police department. And we would love it if there were ways to make sure that there was like a statute of limitations on what the police could do with it. So we think about places like in St. Louis, during the protests, they would literally just film you. And then they come back like 4 weeks later being like, you threw that rock. And you're like, well, that seems crazy. So we don't think that those things are productive ways to think about body cameras, which is the biggest piece of technology that people talk about.
We have a question here. Yes.
My name's Christine. I don't want to take the focus away from looking at police because I think it needs to be done. But I'm curious of all three of your opinion on citizenship and citizenship skills. And I get the impression that we're voting on things sort of like we're liking things on Facebook. Like, we don't really get the consequences of what we're voting on, or we're not fully engaged. Or the last time I saw political engagement at the citizen level was when Obama was running for election and gave leaving room conversation kits on how to discuss issues. And I'm wondering if, like, just what your thoughts are on that, on citizenship skills and engagement and really understanding the kind of community we want to build, and do we have the skills to do that?
Interesting conversation, but again, I just immediately think there's a whole sector of population that can't even begin to engage in that conversation because they're not citizens and they're here without papers. So,
Maria, can I touch on a little bit something before we leave that last topic?
Yes.
Because I'm going to try and give you a police perspective of what I just heard. And what we've been hearing for the past 2 years, you need to get out there in the community. You need to go out there and talk. It's too late after the event has happened to get out there and build up your political capital. You need to be out there talking with the community at all times, at basketball events and things such as nature. Also, we've been hearing you need to have body cameras. We need to record what you're doing. We need to have transparency and accountability for your actions. But now, this is the first time I've heard, but if you're out there and you have body cameras, we think you're surveilling us, so we don't like that. So what are we supposed to do? How do we resolve all of those issues there if we're being told, do this, but if you do this or you do this, you're probably going to do this, and we don't like that. So we can't win with that type of mentality. We've got to have a little bit of truth to what's being said there, and technology is not the panacea to solve everything, but it is bringing that attention on some of the things that have been going on, because with all the phone cameras and the video cameras out there, if that hadn't been out there, we wouldn't know about any of these events that have happened in the past 2 years, and we wouldn't be having these conversations at the level we're having them now. But it has to be a judicial use of that technology, and I think that's what I heard D-Ray say, is that we rush to say, this is going to solve everything, this is going to solve everything, but it brings up unintended consequences and unintended issues that we've never dealt with as a society before. You know, what police are doing now with social media and with filming protests, we're doing things from places that we have a right to be. We can look at social media like everyone else. We can film like everyone else is out there already with their cameras filming. So what's different about police? But then the outcomes afterwards are something we've never dealt with before. And there has to be some thought and discussion about what do we do with that information and how is that used.
So I would just push and say that, like, what's different is that you have the legal right to kill people and I don't. And it means something when your body shows up in a place with a gun. Like, I think about in Ferguson, it wasn't as if the police were just out there with cameras. It's like they were out there with cameras and guns. And that fundamentally changes the way we think about it. So it is true that people have said the police have not been present. It is also true that the people have said that there should be body cameras. And we believe that we don't live in this black and white world, that it's not either or, but it is a both and, that there's a way for the police to be present in a way that is not surveillance. There's a way for the police to be present that's not oppressive to people. But the reality is there are a lot of communities that don't want the police like ever present in them. And I think about the Upper West Side is a place where the police are around. They are not like they are every single moment of the day. And I think that, like, if we live in a world where the police say, like, either I'm here every moment or I'm not here at all, like, I think that's a dangerous way to think about this work.
Can I, sure, can I answer this question?
Yeah.
Because I appreciate the question. Earlier we talked about Sheriff Arpaio and him being an elected official. This is again where we have to take responsibility as citizens, right? So, you know, many law enforcement officials, particularly sheriffs, are elected. You know, sheriffs are often the people who you see evicting people from home. They have a lot of power in neighborhoods in Baltimore and other places that should Milwaukee. Matter to us, Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. You know, municipal judges, we're going to be talking about that with Steve Bright in a panel that's going to follow this one, you know, who were allowing the system in Ferguson to happen, where basically people were being arrested and they were using the warrant system to kind of fund their own system. DAs across the country are elected. If we're honest, people in this room, all of us have gone into the voting booth. We've looked at the list. You know, we voted for the president. We voted for the governor. We voted for the senator. We voted for the mayor, maybe the city council. And then it said the judges, and it said pick three. Mm-hmm. And you just picked three that were like the political party you like. You have no idea who they are. And you just did it. So part of what's required is for us to take seriously the work of citizenship. And citizenship is actual work. Work means that you actually set aside time to educate yourself about what is required of you, just like you would do in your own job. So if you know that election day is coming up like this November, by now you should be also already thinking about, like, oh, what, I mean, I know we all care about the presidential election, but like what other offices are up for election and how am I going to engage? I got time now to learn. The League of Women Voters puts out things. There's materials out there about who the different candidates are. I'm going to attend one candidate forum this year in my community. I'm going to go to the school board forum. Pick one. This idea of who we are and what it means to be to have the responsibility of citizenship is really important. Citizenship is not something that you wield against other people by calling, saying, though, they're undocumented, so they're nothing, and I'm a citizen. No, it's responsibility and work. We do an extraordinary amount of work around voting rights, and we just actually released a report about all the different voting changes that have been made since the Supreme Court Shelby decision that are designed to keep minorities from participating in the political process, especially in the South. Because people recognize that voting is power if it is used properly. And so I think it's really important for those of us who care about these issues, who watch the video and say, oh my God, how could that have happened? Oh, this is so awful. I don't agree with this verdict. What's this town coming to? All the things we say, to take very seriously the responsibility of citizenship. And I think most of us are falling down on the job.
So I'm thinking about the bigger question and how we, as a country, and I know that Aspen, the whole festival is about nonpartisan perspectives, but the truth is that this conversation is happening within the context of a very divisive moment in our country, right? And I just wanted to kind of plant that seed to see if any of you want to incorporate that as you answer some of the questions that we're going to turn to here. Like, we're at a moment in our country where, you know, part of the narrative is saying, diversity, oh my God, it's amazing. It's going to be great for business. It's like the future. We've got so many ideas. We all love each other. And the other side, which is build a wall, incarcerate, you know, arrest, separate, segregate, and both things are happening at the same time. So within that larger two narratives, how do we move forward? Yes, your question.
Hi, my name is Kay Swift. I'm from New York City. I live in Oakland. I work for Youth Speaks. So my question, I want to seat it in something that I find interesting when we talk about policing as a matter of public welfare, where I think about the historicity of policing of indigenous bodies and black bodies as being invested in private interests. And we see this repeating itself in the private privatization of prisons, as well as the reinforcement of the narratives that limit the perceptions of black and brown bodies through mass media that are all funded by the same holding companies. The same companies that are invested in private prisons are also invested in mass media. I'm saying all of that to, again, reseat this conversation that is framed as public welfare as really being about private interests. And this stems from slave catchers to Indian constables onto black codes. I mean, if most of you have read, which should be a must read, the new Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander, that's been broken down in facts and figures. I'm just like framing it really quickly. My question is, given that, given the background that I come from, where we don't like to bring police to the table when we're talking about police terror that happens in our community, police brutality that happens in our community, right? And we're trying to figure out how to rebuild that trust. And if police are going to be invited to spaces that I'm involved in organizing and they can't come in uniform, can't come with badges. So I'm going to get to the question. The question is, how do we re-engage our conversation of justice back to people defining justice and it not being this top-down, state-driven movement?
I mean, Cheryl Lynn's been talking about that, right?
I mean, I do think that, you know, I use the word we a lot, and we encompasses everybody, but it's the different levels of we. I do think we have to recognize our ability to construct elements of our own community. And I would be the last person to say that there are not strong forces pressing against many of the things that I fight for in the civil rights realm. There's no question about it. But I also think that, if you look at the last 2 years, and actually you look at the 10 years before, you know, in New York, the way in which, you know, stop and frisk came to the fore was out of a community movement. It did not come from the top. It came from a community movement. There was litigation. There were two pieces of litigation, one of which we led and were involved in, suing the police regarding, you know, these tactics on the street. But it was a community movement. It was narrative. It was the voices of young African-American men writing op-eds in the New York Times saying, let me tell you about the 20 times I was stopped between age 14 and 20, and that resonating for people. It actually happened organically. It took a while, but it happened organically. And that was before Ferguson. So sometimes I think we don't know that we have more power, and we are actually exercising that power. And so what we've seen over the last 2 years since Ferguson, and this is part of what DeRay is referring to, is the taking of a certain power. We're in this room right now having this conversation because of the narrative that was advanced by young people who said, we've had it. I just started out saying, this problem has existed forever, for decades, but somehow it's come to the fore, and it's come to the fore because people took hold of it, particularly young people, and said, I demand that you look at this video and see the truth. So we should recognize that that power is actually happening and can happen.
And kind of own that power and allow, because I think you said also that sometimes there's a sentiment of like,
it's too big.
It's just too big.
Yeah.
And I certainly feel that way oftentimes, but you know, in my work as a journalist, it's planting that one story that then hopefully takes off, that creates a different narrative. Questions? You're very wrapped in. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
So I really, Leslie Poole with the Seed Foundation in Washington, D.C., and I just really appreciate all your feedback. 52 years old, African American woman from San Francisco, and I have been listening to the narrative, but have lost my voice. And so my question earlier was, as a citizen, then what is my responsibility and how do I re-engage? And I just wanna say, keep having the conversation, because there's those of us out there that are overwhelmed by it because it seems so big and are trying to figure out how to engage and how to find voice again. And so definitely appreciate your feedback on how and where we should engage. But I just would ask that you be aware that there is a group of us out there who are overwhelmed by it all and are being stuck because of the fear of what might happen to us, right? And I'm, you know, I'm educated, but I'm still afraid.
Right.
And so I thank you for your feedback, and I look forward to responding differently in the future.
And we get two questions. There are two beliefs and two questions. One of the beliefs is that we believe that there are more people who want to do good work than know what to do, and more people that want to do good than want to be members, right? That there are people, if we said be a member, people are like, eh. If we said do these three things, they're like, yes. And you're like, okay. And then people often ask us, what can I do? What can I read? And I think that the movement space has been slow to sort of make that easy for people to opt in. And I think we're trying. I think the reality is when a lot of people started asking, we were still literally in the middle of the street. So when I think about this question about top down, bottom up, it's like we were in the street in Ferguson for over 360 days. You know, it was like as bottom up as I can ever think of, and cities across the country. But I think we're trying to figure out how do we help people think about organizing differently and that they can actually organize. Like organizing is saying, I think the world can be different. Here's how. Let me find people who believe that with me. And somewhere along the way, organizing became this like mythical thing where you needed like a call from the ancestors and da-da-da-da-da. And like we just think that's like we don't reinforce that. But we do like to help people like know that they can actually start getting together in little groups, and that's where the best organizing happens. And if they want to join a group that exists, like they can do that too. But some of this really, I think about in Ferguson, like some of the stuff that we did that we look back on that was actually really amazing. We were like sitting in the car and we're like, I think we should shut that intersection down by playing games. And somebody was like, let's go get some games. And like we did it, and it was like one of our most successful actions. So like I never want to discount that. And the last thing I'll piggyback on about what it means to be a citizen, I was just running for mayor, and I think that what is interesting is I went to so many forums. You know, we knocked 20,000 doors in the last 30 days. I did more house meet and greets than I can remember. And what I realized really quickly is that when candidates don't have the answer, what they do is repeat the problem, and we become accustomed to that. That people actually don't have an ear for what solutions sound like and don't actually know how to push people in the solution work. Because somebody will say, well, what are you going to do about the school system? The school system is broken. And the person will say, the school system is really broken. And the person will be like, yes. And you're like, what? You know, so I'm sitting in these, and, you know, I say, we're on a panel like this, and the person will be like, the school system is broken, and people start clapping. And I'm like, this is wild, right? So we do need to do work in priming people to actually, like, listen to the solution work, because we've become so accustomed to rehashing the problem over and over in public.
So we have like two more minutes to end. So I don't know if I can jump in. That's up to include your question. I kind of am looking to the organizers as to whether or not we can. Okay. Nope. Yes. One more. Just do speed talking, please.
Okay, my name is Larissa Fries, and I'm with Sojourners. And you've been talking a whole lot about narratives. And I just want to name that the reason why narrative is so important is that the foundation of this country is built on the narrative of white supremacy. And that is so important to name. And I just came out of a several-day conference looking at the intersectionality of race and all the issues that we're working on. And one of the things that's ringing true to me is quote that was given by Brittany Packnett, one of your esteemed colleagues in the movement, who says, we don't need allies, we need accomplices. And you all have been four amazing voices on this topic, but one of the things that we needed in that four-day conference, where there was, you know, a wonderful diversity of people from all different backgrounds, is you have a number of white folks, people who look like me, who leave being like, I'm being hit with all of this stuff for the first time, or still grappling with it, and I don't know what to do instead of just mire here in my white guilt. And we actually had spiritual directors on hand to help people move through a place of white guilt to action. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to that, the important role of white folks in moving to a place of accomplices in this important movement you're talking about.
Anyone want to take that in 1 minute?
Well, I'm just going to give my small piece. It's one of the reasons why I talk about the work of civil rights as democracy work. I lead a black legacy organization. I'm very proud of an organization that was created in 1940 by black lawyers. That was kind of a big deal. And proud of what we did in the transformation of this country. You know, without Brown versus Board of Education, this room doesn't look like it looks. So we're proud of the role we played. But the role we played was in reshaping what democracy means in this country. And thus, I do not accept the idea that it is the work of black people to resolve civil rights problems alone, or Latino people to resolve issues of immigration and discrimination alone. I don't think, or LGBT people. I think if you regard yourself as a citizen, a wannabe citizen, or a person within the borders of this country, it is your responsibility to be working on perfecting this democracy. And that's what civil rights work is, because what you do to determine whether your democracy is strong or not is that you look to how it plays out in the lives of the people at the bottom and the people at the margins, not how it plays out in the life of people who are comfortable. That's how you can tell whether it's working. And that's the work that everyone should spend some small part. You don't have to do it full-time like I do it. You have to do it full-time like DeRay does it. But you've got to spend some part of your life, some part of your year, thinking that you have to contribute to the perfecting of this democracy and to the repair of this democracy. It's like a house. It always needs repair. You don't just buy your house, live there for 50 years, never replace the roof, never replace any pipes, never do any painting. You do all kinds of stuff. You check the foundation. That's what a democracy is like. So if we've discovered that our law enforcement system is broken, it's everybody's job to fix it.
DeRay.
I just say quickly that what we talk about often is that allyship is an invitation, not a self-appointment. That you actually have to stand with people who are at the margins or who are in the communities and ask them what they need and then try and fill that need, as opposed to going in and being like, this is exactly what you need, let me do it, which is what a lot of people do.
So just my final thought on that, and on the panel and on everyone, I want to thank everyone for being here and for all of you for making the decision to be here and having this conversation. You know, the Buddhists say that it is in the time of the most discomfort that we can do the greatest amount of learning. I hate that, but it's true. It really is true. And they also talk a lot about, and this is something that I'm trying to work a lot in my life, because like everybody here, we're, you know, there's a lot of negativity, right? And we have to be filled with gratitude that we have the possibility to be here, actually talking with each other and engaging with each other and even disagreeing with each other. And that is actually what an engaged democracy looks like. That it is about voting, but it's also about those small protests against stop and frisk in a small community-based organization more than 10 years ago to being here. And that ultimately, we can't give up. Seriously, right? I've heard so many people say, well, if Donald Trump wins, I'm leaving. And I'm like, really? This is the time when you need to be staying, when we need you the most. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much.